from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
We are getting word now from our reporters at the Justice Department that the acting FBI director, Andrew McCabe, has told his staff that he plans to step down.
I don't think there's been any credible allegations against the President of the United States, and I don't think the President of the United States, unless there are credible allegations, which I don't believe there are, should be sitting across from a special counsel.
The interesting part about the list, it's sort of divided into two separate categories. One of them is Russian political figures who are close to Vladimir Putin and the Russian government, and the other are Russian oligarchs.
Manafort's career involved all sorts of shady dealings. He was getting paid for work he had done for all sorts of authoritarian characters, shady goons.
Stand by, take one.
He had a longtime fear of being poisoned. One reason why he liked to eat at McDonald's. Nobody knew.
My duty and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream. Because Americans are dreamers too.
That, of course, from the State of the Union address last night, that's where we will start our conversation today. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Our Democratic political analyst, Bill Curry, is here as well. Hi, Bill.
Morning, sir.
And Liz Karanowitz is here, our Republican political analyst. Hello there, Liz.
Good morning.
So it was a speech that used some well-worn political tropes. We've seen these in speeches before. In a very Trumpian way, he did go a bit over the top with some of them. It was a very, very long speech, the second longest behind only Bill Clinton. It used a pretty dizzying number of average Americans as props to tell some pretty inspiring personal stories and also to prompt some long passages of very uncomfortable public grief. And it hinted at bipartisanship at times. You could tell, Colin, because Trump would wave with a flourish at the Democrats in attendance whenever he said something he thought that they would like. My small analysis here is it really seemed aimed at bridging a different gap in his own party over the issue of immigration, and we'll get into that amongst other things. But first of all, what was your big takeaway from last night, Colin?
Well, it was long, although on paper it's not necessarily that long. His delivery was slow. The original draft by Lord Vader was much we shouldn't have taken that long to deliver it, but his delivery's a little on the slow side. I don't know. There's two ways to look at this speech. One way – well, actually, let me precede that by saying – these speeches are watched disproportionately by people who already agree with the person who's speaking. So the number of people who tune in who are simply curious about what any given president has to say is less than you might think. So he's already talking probably to an awful lot of people that either agree with him or are inclined to agree with him or want a reason to believe in him. He's not really, for the most part, talking to unaffiliated voters who don't lean right and not talking to Democrats very much. And so when you look at it from that point of view, it's probably kind of an effective speech. One of the reactions that I thought was interesting was that of Frank Luntz, who has been kind of critical. Frank Luntz is a Republican consultant. He's from around here originally, specializes in particular on language that can motivate people. He's very interested in converting dry, abstract language into visceral, emotive language. He really liked last night's speech. He went as far as to apologize to Donald Trump on Twitter for having criticized him in the past. And so as somebody who doesn't necessarily share the policy objectives of Frank Luntz, I get a little nervous when he is that enthusiastic about his speech. I think it had a lot of demagogic elements in it that I think worked pretty well and were pretty well expressed, so that at the end, yeah, you've got a whole chamber of Republicans anyway chanting USA, USA. I'll say just two characterological things about it. One of them is I thought the vision of the speech, at least in terms of America's place in the world, was a fairly lonely one. What I heard anyway was a description of America as an exceptional country, less reliant on its allies and more reliant on its individual might, an America that lives on a planet where there are a lot of enemies. There are enemies trying to get into the country. There are enemies in other countries who have to be dealt with. I didn't hear very much about allies other than Israel. And I think that's significant. Also, the reaffirmation of Guantanamo, I think, was also kind of a signal to the Muslim world that we're prepared to have a pretty antagonistic relationship. I mean, I see Guantanamo as an incredible recruitment poster for Muslims who become very angry at us. I wouldn't be putting it in a State of the Union address if I wanted to make sort of peace. So I'll say the other thing that alarmed me was it's one line in the speech, but a lot of people have pounced on it. And it's the one that says that he wants to authorize his cabinet secretaries to get rid of people in the federal government who undermine the trust of the American people. And to me, that is a permission slip. And it's really about something we'll be talking about a lot in the second segment. I think one of the big surprises for President Trump when he arrived in Washington, it's a little bit of a surprise probably for every president, but it's a big surprise for him how many people he has to deal with who work in the federal government who don't necessarily salute his particular flag, right? There's just a lot of people there. In this case, a lot of them have worked for the Department of Justice, you know, who just don't do what he says and have been there a long time and may even work counter to his aims. And his reaction has been to get rid of as many of those people as possible. And I think you heard that last night, and we'll talk probably in segment two about a specific group of those people.
Bill, your thoughts, just quick thoughts off the top here about the big themes that you heard. I mean, Colin says it may have been an effective speech for what Trump was trying to do, but there's some of the vision that he's very scared about. What did you hear?
First of all, you know, having helped write the longest State of the Union speech ever given, that probably won't surprise anyone here. Which was long for a different reason. This was long because so much time was spent introducing people who were more sympathetic than the speaker. The Clinton speeches were long, not because he used a lot of words to describe an idea, but because he had so many ideas. And they were well-liked by the public because people agreed with him. Trump couldn't be specific last night because his specific ideas aren't popular. 70% of people opposed the wall. 70% opposed the tax cut. 70% opposed the Republican health care bill. It goes on and on and on. So he has to be thematic. I thought he did a good job of that. I can tell you that nobody actually writes a State of the Union. It's done by a committee and a really big one. One thing I saw last night was that unlike the inaugural that was shanghaied by the real Darth Vader, Steve Bannon, as opposed to Darth Vader's apprentice, Steve Miller. This was one that showed that John Kelly, if he can't get control of Trump, at least has control of the White House. It was a disciplined speech. It was done not, you know, everybody wants to take Trump's Twitter account away, including all of his friends. You can't riff a State of the Union. You have to read from the machine. You know, Bill Clinton riffed, but you can't do it that night. And so it was the one night where Kelly was able to marshal the resources of the administration and keep him on message. The problem, if I can just add one thing, is entirely in the specifics, all of which were inaccurate. And because the Democrats agree with Frank Luntz and have their own sort of George Lakoff, Drew West, and we're going to fight this out on themes, metaphors, memes, and messages, we pay a price for it right now. I thought Joe Kennedy's response was fabulous, but it would be nice to have someone get up and say, by the way, nobody under $24,000 a year was paying taxes last year. As Mitt Romney pointed out, 47% of people don't pay that tax, but they still pay more taxes than the wealthy because the FICA tax and the property taxes. By the way, the only reason we don't have an agreement on immigration is that you want $25 billion for a wall that no one wants and that you promised that Mexico would pay for. And I'll stop, but the list goes on and on. And at some point, standing up and saying, you know, jobs, there were more jobs generated in the last 2 years of the Obama administration than this year. That's actually a problem. If we're growing the economy faster but producing jobs slower, that's a problem. Last thing is that I think that Trump did well last night. But unwittingly, the amazing thing about it was to me was that he, in a sense, traded places with Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton ran all last year on the idea that this economy is good, that mere growth is good, that a stock market is good, that we can look at global finance capitalism and say that it's working pretty well for average people. Last night, Donald Trump became Hillary Clinton. And in a way, Joe Kennedy became Donald Trump, at least in this one way, of being the person to say, hey, hold on. Hold on. We're not creating the kinds of jobs we want. Wages aren't going up in the longest economic expansion in any meaningful way. These are all the people who were left out. And so in a way, as Trump has aligned with McConnell and Ryan, he has switched places on the one issue that got him here.
Let's turn to Liz with some of your thoughts about the speech, about how effective Donald Trump was in delivering what he was trying to deliver, but also in some of the actual content.
Well, look, I have to agree with Frank Luntz in terms of somebody who, you know, sort of been openly, you know, questioning, you know, some of the approaches the president has taken, and particularly in terms of rhetoric and style. I think last night was unpredictably predictable, right? I mean, you know, it looked, sounded, felt like a State of the Union we've heard before. I think, you know, the reaction from people, according to CBS poll, 75% of the people that watched the State of the Union approved of the speech. 54% of the people that watched it thought that Donald Trump should get credit for the economic turnaround. So I think what gets lost in some of this are that we do have a political conversation about the perception, and perception is reality in politics. And what I saw in Joe Kennedy's response, and the fact that you had five people on the Democrat side responding, was fracture, was not a cohesive message, was not a party that's really running in opposition or with a vision in contrast to the president, but a party that is not prepared for a midterm and not ready to lead with a different vision. So I think that if Republicans are going to get unified behind a message, and look, you know, this could all turn around. Rhetoric, this was a moment in time, as all things are in politics. And I think, you know, if there's a lot of things that can change, and we'll probably talk about some of those things here in the rest of the show. But to me, what was shocking was the response on the Democrat side. I was very underwhelmed by Joe Kennedy's response.
But before we get to the fracture within the Democratic Party, I just want to quickly ask you, though, about the fracture in the Republican Party that, again, I viewed Trump, Liz, as trying to bridge. There's incredibly hardline conservatives who really want to double down on immigration reform. Donald Trump has been playing both sides of this issue. He wants to give a pathway to citizenship.
He wants to make a deal, right?
He wants to make a deal, and this is what he always says. But it doesn't really feel like he's trying to make a deal with Democrats, who are very suspicious, quite rightly, I think, of what promises he or Mitch McConnell might make around this stuff. But he wants to make a deal with the various fractions of his party over immigration and some other key issues.
Well, I thought the overtures and the framework of an immigration platform that he put forward last night were things folks could be hopeful about. I think some of the wall conversation is interesting because on the one side you hear sort of one piece of it, and then, you know, I was listening to Joe Manchin, who's a Democrat senator from West Virginia, talk about what the substance of that wall is. And it's not you know, Trump uses the word wall, but on the practical application side, the technologies and some of the things that are the substance of the policy are not exactly the same as I think what a lot of people would infer. So I think that, as you said, the devil's in the details. So we'll have to see what happens. But I think there's a lot to be hopeful for in terms of the immigration policy and in offering amnesty and citizenship.
I will just say, with some of my family from West Virginia, Joe Manchin is a Democrat in a kind of unicornish kind of way.
Sure.
I mean, he doesn't necessarily represent very much of the rest of the
Democratic
Party. So
would you all say he's a dino instead of a rhino?
I think maybe he's a dino, yes.
So just quickly on the polling stuff. You got to watch the polling stuff. CNN's poll said something very, very different. They actually have a trend line. They've been doing this kind of poll for 20 years.
It's the best stat of the night.
It's the lowest rating that they've ever seen. It was like 48% or something like that. But, I mean, I would throw out all these polls. They're not good polls. The CBS poll oversamples Republicans because Republicans are the ones who are watching the State of the Union address. I don't think any overnight reaction polls are kind of worth talking about. On the immigration deal, what I hear on the immigration language last night, what I heard was a little bit of a softening of Trump as opposed to the Trump on the campaign trail, right? The Trump on the campaign trail was throwing out much more red meat, but not much softening. It seemed as though what he did last night was take the immigration issue, where he zigs and zags and zigs and zags to the consternation and puzzlement of both parties. I thought he zagged towards a pretty red meat approach last night. I didn't think that was the kind of rhetoric that could lead to any kind of deal with the Democrats. If in fact he were to stick to that set of ideas and that set of language, he doesn't get a deal from the Democrats. But once again, I think State of the Union addresses are increasingly aimed at a base. And I think this State of the Union address was probably the first campaign speech of the 2020 season.
I'll be interested to see the ratings and not just the polls that are taken by these various people.
But I agree.
If the ratings are down, Trump will probably claim that there's a conspiracy in the Nielsen company. and it would be kind of like inaugural too. This was his first State of the Union, but second formal address to Congress. And the first one was better and was much better received. And it was exactly as disciplined as this. And it had many of the same themes. Within 36 hours, he was off on a toot as soon as he wasn't reading from a machine. So there are lots of reasons not to be too excited about this.
Which is why I said the moment in time.
There were four Republicans rebutting Obama's last State of the Union and three the one before that. The opposition party's always fractured until it finds a candidate. I agree about this Democratic Party. It doesn't have a policy. It doesn't need a message. It needs a platform. It needs a response. How much better Joe Kennedy's speech, which I liked a lot, from a rhetorical standpoint, from an optics standpoint, but how much better it would have been if he'd said, "This, by the way, is our health care proposal. This is our tax plan, and it's better." If he'd rebutted some of the basic arguments of the Trump speech, pointed out some of the inaccuracies, and then most importantly, put an alternative down on the table.
You would have to actually have that alternative at hand, though, right? Which is something I don't think that the Democratic Party has coalesced.
No one does. That's why I was agreeing.
I think that was sort of my point. Is principally there's no platform. There's hysteria, and we know what we don't want, but there is nothing that we do want. And on the Joe Kennedy point, what I thought was interesting was, you've got a white man from the Northeast who belongs to one of the most privileged political dynasties in this country's history, offering the response to the State of the Union on behalf of the Democrat Party. My point is that this is about the future, and all we're hearing is we need more women, we need more people of color, and we need to, you know, grow the party base. And they went to history, not to tomorrow. And I think when you've got Hillary Clinton continuing to be part of the conversation, if I'm a Democrat, I'm looking at this going, this is not where we need to be going.
Let's actually hear just a little bit from Joe Kennedy's response last night.
You serve, you rescue, you help, you heal. That, more than any law or leader, debate or disagreement, that is what drives us towards progress. Bullies may land a punch, they may leave a mark, but they have never, not once, in the history of our United States, managed to match the strength and spirit of a people united in defense of their future.
A little bit of Joe Kennedy, Colin?
I actually agree with Liz more than I agree with Bill about this. I actually thought – I know the consensus on the left was that this was a good speech. I thought it might have been a good speech delivered by Joe Biden. First of all, unfortunately, optics are really important. And so here's this kind of slumpy-looking kid, basically, in a shirt but no tie. And I know the whole idea is that you can't equal the majesty of whoever is giving the State of the Union address, so you probably go in the other direction and say, well, here I am with the people in this ratty place in Fall River.
It looked like a nice school.
Well, I guess so. But
yeah, ratty?
I don't know. It's like Go Wolverines. It
reminds me of a recent
like
Trumpism.
Well, except you wind up looking like somebody running for student council president, which is what he looked like to me. I thought the delivery was kind of flaccid.
You remember how old we are, right?
Right. Yeah. I know, but I wouldn't be motivated by that if I were an undecided voter. I wouldn't be rallied by that if I were a Democrat.
First of all, the reason they chose Joe Kennedy is that he's young. And their entire congressional leadership is a doddering gerontocracy,
There's lots of young Democrats in America, Bill. And I guess I just wanted to Liz's point. Colin backs her up on this. When you roll out a Kennedy, there's two different things that happen. One is because it's a Kennedy, there's all of this baggage that comes with, and you have to live up to something that it's very, very, very hard for people to live up to. I just can't imagine that there aren't other Democrats who are young and who can deliver a speech in front of a small group of people in front of them and a large group of people watching, other than a Kennedy.
That's how about the
first of all, there aren't. Okay, that's and that is one of the problems for their party at this point, and they haven't cultivated people of substance of vision, and that's one of the reasons they're in the hole they're in. But secondly, I would just say, everybody think back to every response speech you've ever seen given and how the following day was a pity party for the poor person who had to give it. A jittery Bobby Jindal, Marco Rubio reaching for a drink, countless people telling their fathers and telling their parents' life stories in order to get sympathy. This is the first time I can remember, I challenge anybody here to think of one in which the guy woke up the next morning kind of a media star. I don't remember the last time. This is considered the jinx job of all time. One of the reasons they chose him was because he was one of the – they thought he might be the first person in a decade or more to pull it off. I think he was.
I think, and to Liz's point, what's the most significant thing that the Democrats and the sort of Trump opposition can point to as a sign of hope over the last month or so? I would say it's the women's marches. You have a huge number of Americans united around a set of issues. To not have a woman give that speech is insane. I mean, I realize that maybe somebody like Kamala Harris isn't such a great idea right now because she's one of the people who's probably going to run for president. The other people who are going to run for president aren't going to like that. But to not have a woman give that speech is nuts.
Liz, I agree. I think the best outcome for Democrats from that speech is that he spoke to their base. And I'm sure that there are people who are ready to open their checkbooks after listening to him last night. If a Kennedy is the future of the Democrat Party, I think Republicans are going to continue to do well in this country.
But before we take a break, I just want to get to one little piece of substance from the speech. So last year when he gave his speech in front of the joint session, he was talking about infrastructure. He had mentioned on the campaign trail wanting to take home some of that money that's been spent in overseas wars and spend it now on infrastructure, $1 trillion last year. Now it's up to $1.5 trillion. The problem, Liz, perhaps, and we talked about this on the show last week, is that if that $1.5 trillion is basically going to come from states and we're going to leverage capital from private sources, that doesn't sound like the federal government trying to fix my roads, bridges, and trains anytime soon.
I think the infrastructure spending, how they leverage it and where the revenue comes from, obviously, is going to have to be worked out. If there's public-private partnership opportunities, if there's ways to, be innovative in the way we fund these things, I think the point we all can agree on is we need to do more in terms of fixing the infrastructure to help improve our economy and to help keep America going. And I think, it sounds like even Democrats in Connecticut's congressional delegation are willing to work with the president on that because they know how important it is to our state and to the country. So hopefully it's something that we can find common ground on and figure out a way to get it done.
Let me just say, first of all, again, it's what I think was wrong with the Kennedy speech wasn't age, gender, or ethnicity or race. It was the absence of factual rebuttal and substantive alternatives. And this is as good an example as any. 1.5 trillion is a figure that probably was picked because it matches the 1.5 trillion they just gave away to the wealthy in that unpopular tax cut. What he appears to be promising is $200 billion or less, which means that his answer on infrastructure is to have the federal government match a lower share of public infrastructure projects than it does now. Just take our own state of Connecticut and think how likely it is that we'll be picking up a bigger share of the cost. He wants us to do it. And I'll just point out lastly that the Professional Society of Civil Engineers says it takes $1.5 trillion just to repair our existing transportation, our broken bridges, and our clean air and water systems. And we're 24th now, down 27th in infrastructure in the world. We are far from number one and falling. No one puts an honest figure on the table. And the idea that when you need $1.5 trillion just for basic maintenance of what we already have, and you're only promising $200 billion, and you're not even going to say where that's going to come from,
is, again, it's the kind of thing that 20 years ago in this country we didn't tolerate in a public policy debate. You had to show up with more facts and something more substance.
Last thought, Colin?
One of the things that I would have liked to hear Joe Kennedy say is that, well, first of all, in terms of infrastructure, where's the money? I mean, where does the money come from? Even if you're not spending as much as you say you're spending, where does the money come from? One of the things I would have liked to hear Joe Kennedy say last night is, I believe right now the second largest expenditure in the federal government, in the federal budget, after military spending, is service on the debt. That's the next thing we spend the most money on. It's just interest payments, the VIG. You know, and as fond as I am of many, many Republicans, including Liz, and I know that they mean it when they talk about fiscal responsibility, as far as
you
I can tell.
You said Liz was the only one you liked.
Well, no, I'm just like Greg Butler. I've got a lot of, you know, but
that's good company to be in.
Ross Garber. But I think they'll borrow money at the drop of a hat. They'll borrow money for almost anything. Essentially, the tax cut has to be done with deficit spending. It is going to inflate the deficit. And so, you know, in a situation like that, if you don't ever look at the debt and look at its relationship to gross domestic product, and then you start talking about more spending, I think it's sort of intellectually incumbent on you to sort of say, well, in terms of our overall fiscal picture, where does this money come from and can we afford it?
He said last night it's going to come from the states, and they have even less of it.
Right.
And that's the intellectually dishonest part.
We've got to take a break. And when we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit more about what's in the State of the Union address. It was also sort of, I don't know, an interesting week otherwise in Washington with Andrew McCabe stepping down as deputy director of the FBI. A lot more to talk about here in the Wheelhouse with Colin McEnroe, Bill Curry, and Liz Kranowitz. I'm John Dankosky. This is the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. If you'd like to join our conversation on the day after the State of the Union address, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us is a Republican political analyst, Liz Kranowitz, Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst, and our own Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on your show today, Colin?
Yes, I do have my own show. We're actually going to be re-airing a show today about arguing and whether or not we're good at it as a civilization. And the reason we're doing that is because tonight I'll be doing a thing at to Watkinson, we're calling it, I think we're calling it Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Bix Beiderbecke? It's a show about jazz and why you shouldn't be scared of jazz.
Oh, nice. So a show tonight at Watkinson.
Some of your
School.
Favorite jazz musicians, including Steve Davis, will be joining us on stage.
Oh, excellent. I love Steve Davis. So that's something to check out. That's tonight. And Colin's got another show about arguing this afternoon. Let's go quickly to Matt in Glastonbury, just with a thought here off the top. Hi, Matt. What's on your mind?
Hi, I just wanted to mention this whole conversation reminded me of Bush 2 and how all his cronies were oil and defense contractor people. And so what do? We went and fought a bunch of wars and threw a bunch of money their way. And how basically that's the same exact thing. What is Trump? He's a real estate guy. He's a construction guy. That's why we're going to have $1.5 supposedly billion or trillion dollars spent on infrastructure. That's why he wants to build a $24 billion wall. And I just think it's all a big joke, and it's a big handout to his cronies. And I just thought that's an important point that people are missing out of this whole conversation.
Matt, thank you very much for your phone call. I mean, he did spend some time, Colin, last night talking an awful lot about getting rid of all those pesky delays in permitting. You know, it takes so long to build anything in America right now. That does sound like someone who's built a building or two.
Yeah, I don't think that that's because he's a construction guy. Well, let me just sort of say this, that one of the ways in which I thought Trump interestingly differentiated himself from George W. Bush during the campaign was that he, in fact, had been critical of a foreign policy that was maybe driven towards the Middle East, that, you know, wars that we didn't explicitly need. You know, he actually, during the primary season, during the Republican debates, attempted, I think, specifically to differentiate himself from that kind of thing. I do think that one of his approaches to governing right now is to streamline permitting to the point where the environment is endangered. One of the problems with focusing on all the things that we wind up focusing on, because he's such an attention-consuming president, is that we don't always know all the stuff that Baby Pruitt is doing over at EPA. And I think we will ultimately reap a whirlwind from that stuff. But I feel like that's a topic for a different show.
The two things. Again, the answer on infrastructure, the point Colin's making, one about permitting. Permitting has nothing to do with our not building more infrastructure. There are trillions of dollars of projects already approved that aren't being built because we don't have the money.
And the actual announcement last night, if you did even the most minimal math, was that he's going to spend less on it from the, as a proportion from the federal government going forward, and not nearly enough to even do repair work. The second thing I'll just say to the caller's point, and again, I wish Democrats were making these kinds of specific concrete arguments. But the second thing is, I said about Joe Kennedy's speech that he was actually talking about the things that that helped Trump in the industrial Midwest. He was talking about all the blue-collar workers who've been left out of this growth, that for whom the stock market rise means almost nothing, who aren't getting wages going up, and for whom jobs really aren't going up, wages aren't going up at all, and they're losing higher ed costs, health care costs, pension security. Their lives are continuing to atrophy. And I thought that Kennedy was good at least thematically on that. And Trump has settled the question of between the Steve Bannon versus Mitch McConnell, John Kelly question. He's going with the Republican establishment, not the populist base in policy. And that's a mistake. Last thing, remember the phrase drain the swamp? That's the thing that Joe Kennedy didn't pick up on and that Donald Trump didn't get near. And that drain the swamp, which drove the final weeks of that debate, it was also clear last night that that theme has been put on the shelf.
But before we move on to other things, Liz, I mean, do you agree with the analysis that from a policy standpoint, Donald Trump seems to be aligning himself now with a kind of a Mitch McConnell wing and getting rid of some of the more extreme voices that also led him to a populist victory?
I don't know. I think that's to be determined, as a lot of these things are. I think that last night you're in the well of the House and you're having you're addressing the people that you need to bring on board to achieve policy outcomes. And so last night, I think it certainly seemed like he was embracing a more traditional sort of Republican messenger. I think some of the messages are still a little, you know, different than some of the traditional Republican messages. But I think, you know, Democrats have done a great job of poking the holes in the policies and identifying things they don't agree with. And one of the things I think, you know, I'm hearing in this conversation is what Democrats have failed to do is offer a substantive alternative. And when you're going into the midterm elections, it's not going to be good enough to not be Donald Trump. You have to have substantive policies. You have to have a response. You have to have a set of policy outcomes that you want to deliver and a way to achieve those if you're going to win elections. And so, you know, I think that the onus is on the Democrats to do the work and figure out what they would do differently, because saying he's bad and saying no is not exactly going to inspire confidence in the electorate.
We were talking about messages a moment ago, Colin. Okay, so what message does it send that Andrew McCabe steps down as deputy director of the FBI? The White House is saying the president wasn't part of this decision-making process. Of course, McCabe very involved in investigations into the president. It's one of two different stories having to do with those investigations that we'll get to this next couple minutes.
Right. Before we get to McCabe, I want to talk about another person who's not going to be part of this administration. I feel like yesterday in the brouhaha over the State of the Union address, about three stories got buried. Hillary Clinton, I think, intentionally buried a story about how she handled the problem of sexual harassment within her campaign. For some reason or other, the Redskins buried a story about who's going to be their new quarterback. And Victor Cha, I just don't want to get through this show without saying the name Victor Cha. Victor Cha was supposed to be the new ambassador to South Korea. He's not going to be the new ambassador to South Korea because he can't handle the policy. He in objecting to what I think he calls the bloody nose strategy of dealing with North Korea, it basically took himself out of the job because he didn't think he could go over there and push that particular policy. He sees it as too reckless, too unaware of. I mean, even Steve Bannon, talked about how you really can't have a military exchange with North Korea without killing insane numbers of your allies in South Korea, and plus there's 230,000 Americans.
Just Americans, citizens who live there.
I thought that was a really significant thing that happened yesterday, and it's almost not going to get talked about because of when it happened. In terms of the McCabe thing, I mean, look, there's a lot of ways to parse that McCabe story, but I think it needs to be put in a larger context, which is, you've seen Comey go, you're seeing McCabe go. It seems as though the Devin Nunes memo, and by the way, C-SPAN captured a little moment yesterday where Trump appeared to be telling a Republican congressman that, yes, 100% the Nunes memo is coming out. I think we all know that anyway. That seems to be going after Rod Rosenstein. I do get a little nervous about that idea. It's kind of like the Saturday Night Massacre by a Thousand Cuts, that ultimately one way of dealing with a troublesome investigation. We already know that he actually ordered the firing of Robert Mueller last summer and then backed down from it. I think that's a troubling thing. And so, you know, you can look at McCabe and talk about, you know, his wife and her political activities, and maybe that's some kind of a reason. But when you put it into the larger pattern, it gets a little disturbing.
Bill?
To my way of thinking, the two overarching issues of our time are climate change. It threatens our species, our economy, our country on levels that most people don't even still haven't grasped. And the attack on democracy across the world. And there is a war. You know, I do fear Putin, not for his tanks, but because of his banks, because of the contagion of thugocracy. And Donald Trump is, one, a cheerleader, a principal cheerleader for every thug dictator that I know about across the world, and it's an embarrassment to America. And secondly, the things he's doing here are often authoritarian. And to say that he had nothing to do with the McCabe thing, he's been out publicly berating in a brutal way the guy and said he got an absolute virtual instruction to get rid of him. McCabe is a Republican. Jim Comey is a Republican who's given a lot of money to Republican campaigns over the years. Bob Mueller's a Republican. The idea that because McCabe's wife is a Democrat and ran for the Senate and got in Virginia and got money from the governor, the head of the FBI voted for Trump. McCabe himself is a Republican, says he didn't even vote. All the people at the tops of these agencies are close and allies of Trump. It's not just what Trump's doing. This is the greatest politicization of the law enforcement, intelligence, and security apparatus of the United States, not since Watergate, but since ever. There's never been anything like this. And our blindness to the threat this poses to our own democracy breaks my heart.
So, Liz, what does your party do about this? Because this is something where you, as Bill said, you know, you've got high-ranking Republicans who are being either forced out of the administration or being called out by the administration. And there's an awful lot of people in the Republican Party probably very uncomfortable with the way Donald Trump is reacting to this investigation, but seemingly not saying very much about it at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the idea that we need openness and transparency, and to the extent that we can do that in a way that doesn't jeopardize security, that doesn't jeopardize covert operatives, that doesn't sort of put our all of our cards out on the table, I think is helpful, because I think of the amount of hysteria and politicization of this is something.
They should get rid of that word.
They should. Thank
so
you
hard.
For
yeah.
using it, though,
so
because it was
hard.
In my. It's like an earworm now, and I'm like, you know.
Yeah.
I think that openness is not a bad thing to the extent that it doesn't jeopardize our security. And so, if that means releasing the memo, but doing it in the context of hearings where Democrats can be a part of it, and that there's two sides to the coin. I mean, I think that
the Democrats have a memo too.
Sure, and so they I'm for two memos. I think that I think the concern is that if there are things that we should know about, then we should know about them, and whether they're Republicans or Democrats, honestly, it doesn't to my mind.
But dueling partisan memos is not how we handle any issue like this in my lifetime.
I understand that, but
this
we're
is
not
a mistake.
I understand that, but this is the time that we're in, and this is where we are, and we have to live in the circumstances we have. I think if we can have
Nunes should be just taken out of the committee. This is such an abandonment, betrayal of the bipartisan principles that have run those committees for my whole life.
One of the
we don't have to be in this time. We can change it.
One of the principles of our bureaucratic force, right? And we have people who, yes, they're Republicans, but they're there to serve the FBI. They're there to serve the American people. So regardless of whether they're Republicans or Democrats, when they're there, they're serving at the pleasure and in service of the American people to defend the Constitution. So their partisanship doesn't – I mean, he could be a Democrat. It would bother me less. I'm talking about at the FBI. So you're running through the partisan registration of the people that are there. I don't necessarily, to my mind, care one way or the other.
No, I wasn't.
what I'm concerned about is making sure that the information gets out there. If there are Republican bad actors, we should know about it. If there are Democrat bad actors, we should know about it. But I think having an open and a transparent conversation about this on both sides, release both memos so we can have a conversation. We can't put the genie back in the bottle here.
I would agree with Liz that if there are things that we need to know about, we should know about them. I think part of the problem is that the situation that we're in right now is the result of that not happening. So let's go way back to the very beginning. One thing that David Frum, another very good Republican, has been saying is that never we should pass a law saying the minute you get Secret Service protection as a president, if you haven't released your tax returns until then you have to. You have to do it right now. So there are things that we should know, and some of those things are in Donald Trump's tax returns. And Frum says also, by the way, that one of the other lessons of this particular moment is we probably also by statute should demand the tax returns of your immediate and possibly extended family and your sons-in-laws and stuff like that. You know, there's a lot of things we don't know that we traditionally know. And Donald Trump has created a problem by not even complying with sort of basic conventions about releasing that kind of material.
I agree with you, by the way.
The problem didn't start yesterday.
I agree with you.
Let me just say, at the close of Watergate, if we just said, the genie's out of the bottle, we're just going to have to live by Nixon's rules. Up until right this second, we didn't have someone by the way, I'm all for transparency. It's in my life fighting for it. This is not transparency. This is taking all the hearings that are in private and leaving them there, all the raw data and leaving it there, and just calling one partisan polemic out of it and releasing that in lieu of the kind of work that government has done all my life. That's – and I don't care which party it is. I didn't go after those guys because they're Republicans. I was criticizing them for politicizing a process that had heretofore, with the single exception of Watergate, since I was born, has been at least genuinely not just bipartisan but nonpartisan. It's come as close to that ideal as you can. And that's going along with the First Amendment and due process and freedom of information. Right now, that's under assault in this country. And that genie, it's not a genie, and it's got to be put back. And it didn't come from a bottle. It's got to be put back where it came from.
We're going to have to take a break. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk about two political dynasties from New Britain. One had maybe a pretty good week. One had not such a good week. We're going to talk about Paul Manafort and a big story written about him, and also the mayor of New Britain getting into the governor's race. We're talking with Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst, Liz Karanowitz, our Republican political analyst, and Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, with Bill Curry, and with Liz Karanowitz. All right, we've got two different stories that kind of emanate from the great city, the hard-hitting city of New Britain, just a couple miles away. One, a big story in The Atlantic called The Plot Against America. Paul Manafort's pursuit of foreign cash and shady deals laid the groundwork for the corruption of Washington is the big takeaway from this article. The other story we'll get to in just a moment, Aaron Stewart, the mayor of the city of New Britain, throwing her hat in the ring for governor. Let's start with the Manafort piece, Colin. I guess I'm wondering, did we learn anything new, or is just the reporting so intense and so deep that maybe we have a little bit more nuance behind a guy who seems to be behind almost every thug and dictator that we've known over the course of the last 30, 40 years?
I would say, first of all, we learned things that are new in a way that is of interest to people who really want to geek out about this particular situation and people who like gossip. So one of the things that we did learn, well, at least I hadn't seen this stuff before, that some Ukrainian hacktivist collective or something had gotten a hold of just a lot of texts that really had more to do with Paul Manafort's personal life, with a mistress that he was supporting, with the fact that he was just overextended in a lot of – we knew that he was overextended. We knew from the language of the indictment that he was fiscally overextended. But it just turns out that some of that was having to support somebody in a rather lavish lifestyle. And then the fact that near the end, he kind of only had one client. And when that when the government of Ukraine changed over, he had no clients. So suddenly he's got a lot of expenses, needs a lot of money, doesn't have a lot of money, and he's doing all kinds of amusing things like telling his daughter that they can only serve hot dogs at the pre-wedding weekend party or something. So at sort of a gossipy level, there's all that kind of stuff. And I think maybe a greater understanding of the fiscal pressures that were on him. Most of the article is about how he has conducted himself as a member of a very powerful, hard-hitting lobbying law firm that did start at a certain point representing kind of strongman clients, representing the interests of, you know, Bill was just talking before about oppressive regimes. Well, those oppressive regimes often need to do business with the United States. This particular law firm was the place to do it. Some of the people in the law firm felt that Manafort was more the orchestrator of that particular strategy than they were. So I don't know. It's a very long but very readable article about a guy who's still kind of a mystery.
I will say quickly, those fiscal pressures stuck out to me too, Colin, in some ways reminding me of Governor John Rowland and some of the things that he did and some of the things he talked about needing to pay his bills, and then he would stake out ways to make money because he felt like he needed to pad the coffers a little bit. Bill, your big takeaway from the Manafort piece?
You know, in one of the great examples of the law of unintended consequences, in 1976, about the time Paul was showing up in Washington, we had our first publicly financed presidential election. And all the special interests in town took the money they'd previously spent on presidents and dumped it into congressional races in a single cycle, more than doubling the amount of money spent. The year before that, there were 64 registered lobbyists in town. Just a few years later, there were 2,000, and their incomes had gone through the roof. The deregulation wave undermined government as rulemaker. Well, the interesting about that argument was the degree to which one person really makes a difference. He really contributed to the corruption that all the things I just described invited. The only second thing I'll say about it is I feel really badly for New Britain. Of my entire life in politics, I've had more laughs there than anywhere, and I feel like the community took it on the chin from this.
No, so in full disclosure, my husband, born and raised in hard-hitting New Britain, so it's a special place in my heart. On the Manafort story,
I knew I liked
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
I knew I liked you.
On the Manafort story, the reaction that I have is, as somebody who's worked on and around campaigns, is as an operative, you don't want to be the story. And you know, you think, at least I do, really hard about what are the things that you do to jeopardize a candidate or a client, or, you know, you don't ever, it's like being a doctor. First rule is do no harm, right? And so I think, you know, that's my reaction when I read it is, you know, you have to do some self-evaluation when you're getting into something like a presidential campaign. You know, certainly there are going to be people that don't like you or they criticize you and what have you. But what are the things that are in your purview that you are jeopardizing
bring to your candidate's campaign or to now his presidency? Just because we have a couple minutes left, let's turn quickly, Liz, to the better news story, at least for some people in New Britain. Okay, so Erin Stewart, mayor of New Britain, says now she's going to get in this race for governor.
Well, she didn't say that.
That's what she said,
so
actually.
What's important though are the tactical elements of this, right? She opened an exploratory committee for statewide office, which includes governor. I think in the public conversation and in her video and in our Facebook Live, it seems governor is the office she's interested in exploring the most. And, you know, I think one of the things that that I took away, she's really excited about it. And she seems to be enjoying this in a way that I think should make us all smile. We've got a lot of problems here in the state. And you know, we need to find ways to fix them. And if we can do it with a smile and in a hopeful way, I think that's a good thing. I think she's going to contribute a great deal to the conversation. I think folks should be excited that she's in the race. If for nothing else, than a different voice and a different perspective.
I got 30 seconds, Bill.
It, just it's for all of our impassioned disagreement over Trump's effect on the democracy, if this whole conversation, what Liz and I have actually agreed on throughout is the lack of substance on the Democratic Party. I see it in both parties. And I look at Aaron Stewart and a number of candidates in both parties, and they all seem fine to me. They seem pretty fungible. I think she has some good candidate skills. I'm stunned when I look at this state and all the horrible things said about the economy. Our economy is in pretty decent shape. Our government's in horrible shape. I'm stunned at the lack of substance in the debate so far.
1 minute, Colin.
All right. So if Aaron Stewart were an actress, her agent would be saying she's 30, but she can play 23. One thing about Aaron Stewart is I think she does come across as young, which is a really good thing in a lot of ways. Although if I were managing her declaration of intent, I wouldn't have had her do it on Facebook Live because it makes her seem younger. It's kind of like Joe Kennedy last night. Yeah, I mean, if you want him to look like Ed Sheeran running for student council, you did a great job. But probably you want to make him look a little bit older, have a little bit more gravitas. I think she needs to add that layer somehow. I think in her future appearances, I know this is a very superficial thing, but campaigns are often superficial. She's got to come across maybe as a little bit older. Either that or she's going to be trading down to a different ticket spot anyway.
Colin McEnroe from WNPR, Bill Curry, and Liz Granowitz, thank you all very much for joining us. Thanks to Kion Wolf and Katie Tolarski for producing The Wheelhouse here on WNPR.